Good afternoon and welcome everyone to today's internet webinar, PCBs in Schools. This is session number two, Identifying and Reducing Health Risks. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Sciences Superfund Research Program. My name is Heather Henry and I'm a Health Scientist Administrator at the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, and I will be your moderator for this session. So before we get started, I wanted to go over a few housekeeping items, and that will allow other people to join us as they're logging in. So when you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page, so in case you want to have any further correspondence with the speakers, we encourage you to look at that web link and access their email addresses and contact them directly. For those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call. So we request that you keep your phone on mute for the seminar. We have allotted time for questions and answers, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask the question by pressing *7 to unmute your phone. After asking your question, please put your phone back on mute by pressing *6. Again, that's *7 to unmute and *6 to mute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute, but please do not keep us on hold. By now, all of you should be joined to the Adobe Connect meeting room and should see a number of windows or pods within the room, which include the presentation materials. Slide number one of the presentation should be visible. I will now move over to our housekeeping slide. If you have problems viewing the slides or shared content, you may click the full screen button in the upper right corner of the shared slide window. That will expand the content. To shrink it back down to normal size, just press the full screen again. If you experience other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that will be covered and follow along manually. Please note we cannot confirm that all portions of a seminar will be available in this manner. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you have problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you are on the phone line, you may need to turn off your computer speakers or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts. You may want to submit questions by using the Q&A pod. You'll see that in the lower right corner. You need not wait until the Q&A period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the Q&A session. Please note, questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. At the appropriate times for the Q&A, the moderator, who is me, will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a phone number so we can reach you and help you troubleshoot your problem. You may also contact our technical support directly, and the phone number is 301-589-5318. Again, that number is 301-589-5318. As stated earlier, we will have a few Q&A sessions. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our related resources pod where we have assembled information that is directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations that were given today. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. Associated with the related URLs pod is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. With that, we're ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute. And again, please do not put us on hold. Our first presenter today is the Superfund Research Program researcher, Dr. Gabrielle Ludwig. She is a professor at the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. She is also the director of graduate studies of the Interdisciplinary Graduate Program in Human Toxicology, where she has many years of experience in the recruitment and training of graduate students and postdocs. In the University of Iowa Superfund Center, Dr. Ludwig leads the training core and is a co-leader of Project One, which focuses on PCBs, metabolism, genotoxicity, and gene expression in vivo, reflecting her extensive training and experience in genotoxicity. Dr. Ludwig has an MS in human genetics and anthropology and a PH in toxicology from the University of Mainz, Germany. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Ludwig, and thank you for presenting.
Hello.
Dr. Ludwig?
Yes, hello. Can
Hi.
You hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you for the introduction, Heather, and thank you for having me here. My topic is mechanisms of toxicity, and that is actually a very ambitious title because there are so many different mechanisms of toxicity that I cannot present them all, and you would need about half a dozen experts in different fields in order to do these mechanisms justice. But I will give a little overview here. And to outline my talk here, I will talk about some of the receptor-driven mechanisms, the H receptor, ranadine receptor, estrogen receptor, and also about metabolic activation of PCBs, which plays a role not only in the half-life, but also with respect to carcinogenicity and genotoxic effects. And then finally, I will give some own impressions about what we have learned. Okay. Do you see my pointer? Yes? Okay. PCBs have a lot of adverse health effects. As you can see here, chloroacne skin rashes were the first ones that were observed in the 1930s in workers in the Monsanto PCB fabrication factories. Chloroacne, eye diseases, chocolate skin, liver enlargements, and then immunotoxicity, endocrine problems, and other human health effects followed later. And last year, IARC determined that PCBs are cancers producing in humans, are human carcinogens. And then finally, a very new finding is the disturbance in energy homeostasis, as I would like to call it, that is an effect on insulin metabolism and obesity and metabolic syndrome. So a lot of different effects on human health, and it's unlikely that they're all caused by the same mechanism. But we have 209 different PCB congeners. And in order to get a handle on this high number of congeners, 209, we often group them in different groups according to the number of chlorines or the position of chlorines on the ring. The number of chlorines, we often have two groups, the lower chlorinated ones, which have four chlorines or less. And I have two examples here. This is PCB3, which is the 4-chlorobiphenyl, and PCB52, the 2,2/5,5/tetrachlorobiphenyl. Higher chlorinated are those that have more than four chlorines. The example that I have here is PCB95, which has five chlorines in the biphenyl ring. The number of chlorines has a strong influence on the persistence of the congener in the human body or in general in the body. The ones with lower chlorination are faster metabolized and therefore disappear very quickly from the body after ingestion or inhalation. And Larry Hansen called them episodic PCBs. The problem is that during this metabolism, they may form reactive intermediates, and more about it later. the higher chlorinated PCBs are more persistent. A lot of them interact with receptors, but it's not necessary to have more than four chlorines to interact with with receptors. The other grouping is according to the position of the chlorines. And again, we have two groups. We have those that do not have chlorines in the ortho position of the ring here next to the bridge, or who have only one chlorine there. As an example, I have depicted here PCB 126, which is a pentachlorobiphenyl. These not dioxin-like PCBs are AH receptor agonists, and more about it later. Then we have the non-dioxin-like PCBs, which have two or more chlorines in the ortho position. The example here is PCB 153, which has two chlorines in the ortho position. These PCBs may interact with other receptors, like 153 is interacting with a CAR receptor, and they can interact with estrogen receptors or ranitidine receptor. And for this, they don't have to have so many chlorines. So non-dioxin-like chlorines does not mean indicate how many chlorines this congener has.
Dr. Ludwig, sorry to interrupt. We've had a couple of requests that, if possible, if you could speak up a little bit.
Okay, I will try to speak louder. Is that better?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I will try to speak louder. And let's start with the first group, the dioxin-like PCBs. They activate the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, AH receptor. This was discovered with dioxin, TCDD, which goes into the cells and there binds to the AH receptor. The complex goes into the nucleus and finally, after several steps, binds to promoter regions and changes the transcription of several genes. The most prominent one in the liver is cytochrome P451A1, and that is often measured as an indicator for contamination with AH receptor agonists. So this increased transcription results in more enzymes, different amounts of regulatory proteins, and as a consequence, a change in the metabolic activity in the cells, which affects not only the exogenous compounds but also endogenous compounds. We often see oxidative stress increases and we have changes in cell behavior. They have different cell cycle regulation and responses to apoptosis signaling, for example. The consequence of these AH receptor agonists in human for human health are multiple. We have seen immunotoxicity, developmental and neurodevelopmental toxicity, changes in thyroid and steroid hormone levels, and reproductive function disruptions, and also cancer with these dioxin-like compounds. Okay. Among the PCB congeners, there are only a few that are dioxin-like, and I have listed them here. The non-ortho substituted PCBs are 77, 81, 126, and 169. And then we have several that have one chlorine in the ortho position. These have quite an effect and are important, especially 126. All of them react through the AH receptor. And it was discovered that with reporter genes, we can measure how strong the interaction with the AH receptor is. And TCDD got a toxicity equivalence factor of 1, and all other dioxin-like compounds are measured in relation to dioxin. And you see PCB 126 has a TEF of 0.1, that is the strongest AH receptor agonist among the PCBs. PCB 169 has the next highest one, 0.03. And then 77, PCB 77, has 0.0001 TEF. This means that even when you have 10 micrograms of PCB 126 and 10 micrograms of PCB 77, in your body, then 77 is 1,000 times less active than PCB 126. That is important to remember. The other PCB congeners have even lower TEFs. There are other receptors. The non-dioxin-like PCBs do not react through the AH receptor, but they may react with other receptors, especially the ranitidine receptor. This is a receptor that regulates homeostasis, and calcium homeostasis, calcium signaling is important in cell signaling. So this is the mechanism by which compounds can become developmental neurotoxins. There are a lot of very exciting new results out. I mentioned here a very recent paper in Environmental Health Perspectives that showed that PCB 95 changes dendritic arborization. That is one mechanism how these PCBs could be neurotoxins. And a lot of work was done by Isaac Pessa, UC Davis. He measured the strength with which different PCB congeners interact with the ranitidine receptor. And he discovered that PCB 95 is highly reactive, and he gave 95 the NEF1. In kind of homology to the TEF, he called it neurotoxic equivalency factor, and 95 has the factor 1. The next, another one that is very high is PCB 194, which has 1.03, but several other ones have also very strong activity, like 85, which has 0.8, and 52, one that is highly concentrated in air, has an NEF of 0.53. 18, also very often found in air, has 0.77. So a lot of different PCB congeners have NEFs, and they are not very different from each other. Unlike the TEFs of the dioxin-like PCBs, which differ in magnitudes, these are highly similar. That has consequences. When you look here at Chicago air, and we look at the different dioxin-like PCBs that glued to the toxic equivalent quantity, then we see that PCB 126 is the major contributor, even though 126 is found only in very, very small amounts in the air and sometimes not found at all. 169 is the next dominant PCB congener. Unlike this, the NEQ, the neurotoxic equivalent quantity, is influenced by a lot of different PCB congeners. Here is PCB 52, which is very frequent in the air. Here's PCB 28, 18. Here is 95. Where we have these new examples with neurotoxicity, and PCB 11, which is a PCB that Carrie Hornbuckle on and her group just recently discovered in pigments. And so when you have paint, newly painted rooms, you may have higher levels of PCB 11 in your indoor air. How do we measure, how do we get these NEQs and TEQs? Well, the nice thing is that when they act, these congeners act through the same mechanism, they act additive, and you can get the quantity by multiplying the amount with the factor of that congener and then have the sum of all the congeners. That's how you get the NEQ and the TEQ. Okay, that is AH receptor and NEQ receptor, but PCBs also interact with estrogen receptors and other androgen receptors and other steroid endocrine receptors. They also may change the half-life of these endogenous hormones by enhancing their metabolism or enhancing their excretion. So a lot of PCB congeners act as endocrine disruptors. And here, for example, you can see that when they act with the estrogen receptor, they may not only influence the uterus, but also other tissues like our bones, for example. And several groups have analyzed the reactivity of different PCB congeners with the estrogen receptor. And here is an example, a table from the group of Makala, and they found that especially lower chlorinated congeners interact with the estrogen receptor and activate the estrogen receptor, whereas higher chlorinated PCBs act as estrogens. The same group of Makala had the year previously, in 2004, published a paper where they showed that hydroxylated metabolites of lower chlorinated PCBs are even stronger estrogenic compounds. And so that means that metabolic activation of lower chlorinated PCBs is not necessarily detoxification. Okay. These were all effects on non-cancerous effects, but PCBs are known to be carcinogenic in humans and animals. And as I mentioned just last year, IARC determined that PCBs as a group are human carcinogens. And carcinogenesis is a multi-stage process. The first step is initiation, which is a change in the DNA sequence. The initiated cell then maybe have an advantage to proliferate when in the presence of certain promoters. And we get pre-neoplastic foci. This is a non-genotoxic event. And further, when we have progression, we may get further changes in the DNA code and malignant tumors. PCBs are complete carcinogens. But the question was, are they really acting on all different stages? And until about a few years ago, it was assumed that PCBs are only promoters. We have different assays to measure whether congeners or whether compounds are initiators or promoters. Here is the mouse skin assay, where we give either a compound one times to see whether it is an initiator followed by promoters, or we give a known initiator and the test compound for a longer time as a promoter. And then we can look for papillomas or carcinomas. Even more popular is a similar assay with red liver assays, red liver tissue. With these assays, a lot of PCB mixtures and congeners were determined to be promoters, which was in agreement with the general hypothesis. But PCBs were not considered to be initiators because they seem not to be genotoxic. And that changed later. Here is a picture of a liver of a rat that was treated with an initiating agent, and yet you can see these nodules here. And a precursor of these nodules are these pre-neoplastic foci in the liver. And Larry Robertson used this assay to test whether PCB congeners are initiators in this Salt-Farber initiation assay. And he found that indeed, several PCB congeners are initiators. And when you look at the structure, you see that all of them are lower chlorinated PCBs. So that indicated maybe it's not the PCB itself, but a metabolite. So he used nine different synthetic PCB metabolites of PCB3, and tested them in this assay. And he found that especially 4-hydroxy-PCB3 and the 3,4-benzoquinone of PCB3 were highly active as initiator in this model. So PCBs seem to be initiators, but that means they should also be genotoxic. So we used a transgenic animal model, the big blue red model, which has a reporter gene, the LUCI reporter gene, to see whether we can find mutations in the liver of these animals. And indeed, when we treat these animals with PCB3, we see an increase in mutation in this reporter gene. This is 3-methylcholantraine, the positive control as a comparison. The 4-hydroxy-PCB3 produced an increase in mutations, but was not significant due to the higher standard deviation. So in vivo, we saw mutations, but can we use a shorter assay, a faster assay, like a cell culture assay? So we used V79 cells and tested PCB3 and all these different metabolites for mutagenic activity. And neither PCB3 nor the monohydroxies or the dihydroxies were mutagenic, but both quinones that we tested were highly mutagenic in this assay. There are other forms of genotoxic damage, like chromosome breaks and chromosome loss that you can see here in the micronucleus assay. So the question was, do PCB metabolites induce this kind of genotoxicity as well? And as you can see here, several of these metabolites of PCB3 induced chromosome breaks in these cells, especially the quinones and also the dihydroxyquinones. And several of the metabolites also induced chromosome loss. And two of them, one of them induced sister chromatid exchanges, the 3,4 catechol, and one of them, the 2,5 hydroquinone, induced polyploidization in these cells. And polyploidization is also strongly linked to carcinogenesis because most of our cancer cells have a close to tetraploid chromosome set. We also saw DNA strand breaks in other cell types with a COMET assay that indicated that it is not the hydroquinone but the quinone that is the DNA breaking congener metabolite. So from these experiments, we conclude that especially the quinones of these PCBs are reactive metabolites that are genotoxic, but also hydroquinones and even monohydroxies can have some genotoxic activities. We could not test the epoxides because they are not available, but we assume that the epoxides will also have genotoxic and therefore initiating activity. So that is genotoxicity. At the end, I would like to mention one other type of DNA damage. At the end of our chromosomes, we have telomeres. These telomeres are there to protect the chromosomes. And the problem is, the older we get, the shorter the telomeres get in most of our cells. And when they get shorter and shorter, then the cells lose vigor, and finally they die. Or if these telomeres are very short, then they become sticky, and we may get chromosome fusions, chromosome instability, and cancer. So short telomeres are not good for human health. Two types of cells do not have this problem of shortened telomeres. The one are our stem cells. They have telomerase activity, which is a complex, and this telomerase activity restores the length of the telomeres. The other type of cells that has telomerase activity are cancer cells. They reactivate the telomerase activity. So stem cells and cancer cells have telomerase activity. We therefore tested whether our PCB metabolites and PCBs can have an effect on the telomeres of chromosomes. And PCB3 quinone shortened the telomeres, which is bad because it's a kind of premature aging of our cells. When we tested the 4-hydroxy PCB, it caused some shortening, but also the PCB3 shortened telomeres. These are results from my student Jim Jacobus, and especially this effect of PCB3 came as a surprise. but Haggard cells can bioactivate PCB3s, so maybe it's one of the reactive intermediates. But since there was a congener that was active, the question was, what about all the other PCBs we are exposed to, especially the PCBs in the air? And here, the top panel, you see the congener profile in the Chicago air, which was determined by Kerry Hornbuckle here in Iowa. And you see PCB 153, PCB 126, PCB 52, which is pretty prevalent in the air, and also PCB 28. We also wanted to know what is the effect of the whole mixture. And Hans Lehmler here in Iowa, in our Superfund group, he produced a synthetic mixture, we call it CHEM, Chicago Air Mixture, which is very similar to what is Kerry Hornbuckle found in the air in Chicago. So we used these congeners and the mixture and tested them with the cells to see whether they have an effect on telomere length. And indeed, all of them shortened the telomeres, including the Chicago air mixture. And all of them, Senthil Kumar found that all of them reduced telomerase activity. So that indicates that they may produce something like premature aging in our stem cells. So to summarize this, PCBs, we believe that PCBs are complete carcinogens because some of them are bioactivated to reactive intermediates that have initiating activity, while the higher chlorinated PCBs change gene transcription and then act as promoters of carcinogenesis. So what have we learned from all of this? PCB congeners are distributed into different groups according to structure and biological effects. And one prominent effect of PCBs are receptor binding and receptor activation. And we have different receptors. One prominent receptor is the AH receptor, but also CAR receptor and the ryanodine receptor and others. Lower chlorinated biphenyls may be bioactivated, and these intermediates then may interfere with bind to proteins and DNA and have damage that way. And a lot of these PCB congeners that act through the same mechanism may have additive effects, where others may have synergistic effect. So my personal impression, in the last 10 years, we have gained an enormous amount of knowledge about the mechanisms of PCB congeners, the toxic mechanisms, especially in the area of carcinogenicity and neurotoxicity. But nevertheless, a lot is not known. We know that we have TEFs for dioxin-likes. We now have NEFs for neurotoxic ones. We know which ones may be bioactivated, which intermediates may be the reactive congeners, but still a lot of work needs to be done. Our knowledge about mixtures is still very, very low. Mixtures are extremely difficult to examine because there are so many different combinations. But we know that PCBs that act by different mechanisms can have synergistic effects. For example, Linda Sargent found that PCB 52 and PCB 77 have synergistic effects with respect to carcinogenicity. So we have to learn more about such mixture effects. And then finally, which is pretty troubling for, in my opinion, we see more and more different human health effects. We now have see a correlation of PCB contamination and autism, that is especially the group around Isaac Pessa and Pam Line in UC Davis. We also have indication for metabolic syndrome, for insulin, effects on insulin secretion, for obesity. And there we don't know anything about the mechanism yet, but we really have to learn more about it. So PCBs, in my opinion, are a perfect model to study the mechanisms because they are so similar, but they have so many different mechanisms, and to examine mixture effects. They are also very interesting because they have so many different human health effects, which we don't understand yet. Finally, the Superfund program. I want to mention that specifically because we need experts from different area. Like in the Iowa Superfund, we have analytical chemists, we have synthetic chemists, we have experts in metabolism, experts in genotoxicity, experts in function of enzymes, and all, this whole group together can then study these effects appropriately. With this, I just want to mention some of the people who were involved. You can read the names. These are only a few of them. There are many, many more. And specifically, I want to acknowledge the support from the Superfund program. And with that, greetings from our currently not sunny Iowa. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ludwig. That was a very informational presentation, and we appreciate the depth at which you went into letting us understand about the toxicity of PCBs. We've made a decision here to move on to our next speaker, and we're going to field questions. A couple questions have come in. However, they're very relevant to the next speaker as well, and so we thought it would be a good idea to move on to our next speaker, and then we'll take some questions at the end of that presentation. So at this point, I would like to introduce our second presentation, our second presentation today. This will be by Dr. Janice Lehman. Dr. Lehman works as a toxicologist for U.S. EPA's Integrated Risk Information System, also known as IRIS. IRIS is a human health assessment program that evaluates quantitative and qualitative risk information on effects that may result from exposure to environmental contaminants. Dr. Lehman is currently working to develop a new IRIS assessment on the non-cancer health effects of PCBs. She received her PhD in toxicology from the University of Rochester. Dr. Lehman, at this point, I'd like to turn it over to you to talk about evaluating health risks from inhaled PCBs, research needs to address uncertainty.
Okay, thank you, Heather. Can you hear me? Okay, just make sure I came off of mute.
We can hear you fine. There have been some comments about having our speakers speak up, so to the extent that you're able to speak as loud as you can, we really appreciate that.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Try and use my outdoor voice.
Yes, outdoor voice.
So far in the series, including last week's first session and today, we've heard about what we know regarding the potential for humans to be exposed to PCBs by inhalation, and what we know regarding some of the mechanisms through which inhaled PCBs might cause toxicity. And my talk is about what we know about the potential for human health risk from inhaled PCBs. Importantly, what we don't know and what we need researchers to do to help us evaluate health risks from this exposure with more certainty. So I will begin with a brief overview of the history of interest in this topic in the United States, and then I'll talk about human health risk assessment of inhaled PCBs with a focus on hazard identification and dose response assessment. I'll talk a little about certainties that we're dealing with in our current human health assessments of PCBs by this route, and I'll continue by identifying the types of data that we need in order to help reduce these uncertainties and the type of research that could be done to collect the appropriate data. As discussed in last week's webinars, PCBs were produced commercially in the United States from 1929 until 1977, and U.S. production peaked in 1970 with a total production volume of 85 million pounds. Because of their unique chemical properties, PCBs were ideally suited for use as coolants and lubricants in transformers, capacitors, and other electrical equipment. They were also used in public building construction as an additive to permanent elastic sealants, caulking, grouts, and paints, and as flame retardant coatings of acoustic ceiling tiles. So an assortment of other products also contained PCBs, and as was last week, some of these PCB-containing materials are still present in public buildings, including schools, which have been an area of particular interest. So U.S. interest in airborne PCBs, or our current focus on it, began to grow in 2004 when Herrick et al. Reported on an investigation of buildings in and around Boston, Massachusetts. And in this study, 8 out of 24 buildings contained caulking materials that had PCB content exceeding the limit of 50 parts per million, which is set by the Toxic Substances Control Act. So materials above this limit are required to be treated as PCB bulk product waste. And one sample of caulking material taken from a university student housing building contained 36,200 parts per million PCB. And as discussed last week, caulking samples taken from school buildings in recent years since this have been found to contain up to 100,000 parts per million PCB. So these findings were by no means an anomaly. Later studies reported elevated PCB concentrations in the air of buildings with PCB-containing caulk, including schools. McIntosh reported on an elementary school in Massachusetts with PCB-containing caulk that had a mean indoor air PCB concentration over 500 nanograms per cubic meter. And to put that into perspective, the typical background concentrations of PCBs in outdoor urban air range from about 1 to 10 nanograms per cubic meter. So while this study focused on caulk as a primary source of PCBs in air, it's important to remember that caulk is only one of a number of potential sources of indoor air PCB contamination. And as mentioned on the previous slide, other sources currently found in schools include window glazing, fluorescent light ballasts, and ceiling tile coatings. Okay, now that we have a better appreciation of the prevalence of PCB-contaminated indoor air that's been established over the past several years, we're very interested in what potential health risks might exist for people who might be breathing that air. And EPA human health risk assessments generally follow the paradigm shown here as it's a group of interconnected processes, including exposure assessment, hazard identification, dose response assessment, and risk characterization. Now, last week's speakers talked about PCB exposure by inhalation. So this talk is going to focus mostly on hazard identification and dose response assessment, and how these steps might be supported by future research. So how can we assess human health hazard from inhaled PCBs? Information for hazard identification comes from studies in humans or animals exposed to a toxicant, such as PCBs. There have been a lot of studies investigating the effects of PCB exposure, and results show associations with both cancer and non-cancer health effects. As mentioned in the first talk today, based on data from both animal studies, the International Agency for Research on Cancer has determined that PCBs are carcinogenic to humans, and this is a fairly recent determination, with sufficient evidence of an association with melanoma and limited evidence of associations with non-Hodgkin lymphoma and breast cancer. Also, according to to studies both in humans and in animals, exposure to PCBs correlates with a variety of non-cancer health outcomes, including thyroid hormone homeostasis changes, immunotoxicity, and developmental neurobehavioral toxicity. These are very consistently observed across studies. Now, although the types of health effects associated with PCB exposure are consistent across studies and across species, there has been far more attention paid to the consequences of oral exposure than to inhalation exposure. Human studies, it's hard to say what the exposure route would be because most exposure assessments in epidemiological studies of PCBs are done by using measurements of PCBs in serum or some other biological matrix. And so body burden, your PCB body burden results from accumulated exposure over time from all different routes of exposure, including inhalation, oral exposure, and dermal exposure. So this particular discussion is more about the animal studies, in which there have been many, many more studies in which animals have been exposed by gavage studies or PCBs in the diet rather than inhalation. In total, there are three intermediate duration studies in animals that can provide information on the effects of PCBs by inhalation exposure. In 1956, Trion et al. Published findings. They saw histopathologic lesions in the livers of rats, mice, rabbits, and guinea pigs exposed to 1.5 milligrams per cubic meter PCBs for 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, for 213 days. However, in this study, they only tested that single dose of PCBs, meaning that there's very limited dose response information provided. And furthermore, over the course of the study, some animals in both the experimental and control groups died from causes unrelated to treatment, and this could confound the association between PCB exposure and the observed liver histopathology. And also, to measure PCBs in the exposure atmosphere, the authors used an analytical technique that has since been shown to be invalid, which results in uncertainty regarding how much PCBs the animals were actually exposed to. In 1999, Casey et al. Published findings in adolescent male rats exposed to 0.9 micrograms per cubic meter PCBs for 23 hours a day for 30 days. It's important to note that this is a much lower dose than was tested in the previous study. They observed histopathological effects on the thyroid and thymus, increases in serum thyroid hormone concentrations, and altered exploratory behavior as measured in open field tests. Notably, the inhalation exposure level tested in the study, not only is it lower than the previous study, but it's also within the range of concentrations observed in some public buildings. So this, if it's an accurate exposure assessment for this study, then it does represent potential human exposure levels. But as in the previous study, only a single dose of PCBs was tested, which limits the available dose response information. And the authors opted to administer PCBs using whole body exposure rather than nose only exposure. And this was to prevent stress to the animals that would result from being restrained 24 hours a day or 23 hours a day. And that's an entirely reasonable decision because the study measured behavioral, endocrine, and immunological endpoints, and these might have been disrupted by excessive stress, not to mention that restraint for 23 hours a day is probably inhumane. But this exposure method does open up the possibility that PCBs were deposited on animal fur or skin and then subsequently ingested by the animals through grooming behaviors. So that makes it so that it's hard to say that the inhalation exposure was the only exposure occurring. Furthermore, like the previous study, there were some methodological issues that produced some uncertainty regarding the accuracy of the exposure concentration in the air. It was reported by the study, so we're not clear whether 0.9 micrograms per cubic meter was truly the exposure level. Finally, the third study, using a nose-only inhalation chamber this time, Hu et al. Observed minimal toxicity in female Sprague-Dawley rats exposed to 0.52 milligrams per cubic meter PCBs for an average of 1.6 hours per day, 5 days a week for 4 weeks. This study reported on a wide array of toxicological endpoints, including pulmonary immune responses, histopathological results, cytochrome P450 enzyme induction, redox status of glutathione in the serum, liver, and lung, and hematological parameters. And all they saw were minimal toxicological responses, including a shift to more oxidized glutathione in serum and an elevated hematocrit in PCB-exposed animals. As with the other inhalation studies, again, only a single PCB dose was tested, and this limits the potential for these data to be used for dose response assessment. Also, the exposure duration of this study was particularly short compared to the other studies. Animals were exposed for only 1.6 hours per day, 5 days a week, while animals in the study by Casey were exposed 23 hours a day for a similar duration. But it's important to note that the nose-only exposure method used in this study probably allowed for a more accurate exposure assessment than was possible in the other two studies, which both utilized whole body exposure. So all the studies have their advantages and disadvantages. Unlike the study by Casey, Hu et al. Did not report histopathological effects in the thyroid, but that was really the only overlapping endpoint that was investigated in both studies. Hu did not measure changes in serum thyroid hormone concentrations, or, which Casey observed, or neurobehavioral endpoints. And there are differences in the designs utilized by the studies. They, you know, one was whole body exposure, the other nose only. They used different PCB mixtures to expose the animals, and the number of hours per day was much different. So it's difficult to interpret differences in the results between the two studies. Of the three studies described here, two did report notable health effects, which does identify inhalation exposure to PCBs as a potential health hazard. But for human health risk assessment, we'd prefer to use dose response data measured across multiple exposure levels. And none of these studies tested more than one exposure concentration. And there are uncertainties associated with the exposures in both of the studies in which health effects were observed. So although there are reasons to believe that inhaled PCBs may pose a hazard to human health, we don't have the data we'd like to support a robust dose response assessment, which would enable us to establish acceptable exposure limits with more confidence. So to support a robust dose response assessment, we'd like to see epidemiological and or laboratory animal-based investigations in which PCB exposure by inhalation is well characterized, and a number of important health endpoints are evaluated. In this spirit, a key objective for future epidemiology studies would be to characterize inhalation exposures to PCBs. Currently, most epidemiological studies of PCBs, like I said earlier, assess exposure based on measures of PCB body burden. And although that's standard practice, given the current state of knowledge, it's hard to disentangle patterns of exposure from this type of measurement. As I mentioned before, measures of PCB body burden reflect exposure integrated over all exposure routes over a prolonged period of time. And when we're interested in determining the potential effects of inhalation exposure specifically, it might be preferable to use measurements of PCBs in air, which reflect inhalation exposure during a specific period of time. In the future, physiologically based pharmacokinetic models describing the kinetic properties of inhaled PCBs might make it easier for us to use biomonitoring data to assess inhalation exposures. And as part of that effort, we would need better information on pulmonary absorption of PCBs, both from vapor and particle phases. And also, there was a recent study published that used modeling to predict that dermal absorption of PCBs in the air might also contribute to exposure. And that's an interesting concept that really hasn't been considered much yet. So dermal absorption may also need to be considered if we're going to try and use biomonitoring data for this kind of assessment. In the meantime, until data and models are available to sort out the contributions from different routes of exposure to PCB body burden, it would be helpful if epidemiological studies of PCB inhalation provided measurements of PCB concentrations in air. They can also present biomonitoring data, but the concentrations in air would be very helpful from a risk assessment perspective. So these epidemiological studies should also investigate associations between PCB inhalation exposure and key health effects that have been identified in earlier studies of PCBs that haven't provided information on inhalation exposure, including changes to serum thyroid hormone levels, increased susceptibility to infection, decreased antibody responses to immunization, and neurodevelopmental effects in children. And populations of interest would include adults and children who are directly exposed to PCB-contaminated air, but also children who are born to women who were exposed to PCBs by inhalation before or during pregnancy and lactation. So dose response data useful for risk assessment may also come from investigations in laboratory animals, and like human studies, there are also important issues to consider for this type of study. Previously, in earlier studies of oral PCB exposure mostly, monkeys and rats have been shown to be much more sensitive than mice to oral PCB exposure, and this suggests that monkeys and rats might be preferred species to use in PCB inhalation studies, as their sensitivity seems to be more closely relevant for human sensitivity. Currently, PCB inhalation has only been all three studies of PCB inhalation in animals have been intermediate duration. So a chronic or developmental exposure study would be useful to fill this data gap. And I may have alluded to this previously, but just to make it clear, our ability to conduct a dose response assessment would be greatly improved if we had data from a study that tested more than one PCB concentration. Investigators also, one of the trickier questions, investigators need to decide whether they want to use whole body or nose-only exposure to expose animals. And as mentioned earlier, whole body exposure might allow for some additional unquantified oral exposure to occur as a result of grooming behavior. But there are also disadvantages of nose-only exposure. The restraint is associated with stress-related responses that might interfere with the detection of exposure-related responses. And also to prevent undue stress to the animals, nose-only exposure is limited to only a few hours per day. And also the systems used for nose-only exposure accommodate only a limited number of animals at one time, which might reduce the total number of animals that you can use in a single study. So keeping these factors in mind, it's hard to recommend one exposure method over the other for all study designs. It might mean that to some extent the best exposure method for a given study might depend on what health points are being investigated and other factors like that. As with human studies, preliminary animal studies should focus on endpoints that have already been established to be sensitive to PCB exposure, including neurodevelopmental effects, decreased antibody responses to immunization, decreased natural killer cell activity, and changes in serum thyroid hormone levels. All the same basic domains that have been observed in human studies. In addition to the study design elements that I've already described, there are additional factors for researchers to consider when planning studies of PCB inhalation exposure, which I hope people will do. One relates to the congener composition of the PCB mixture. Based on their congener compositions, PCB mixtures differ in their physicochemical properties and toxicity, which used to be over here. For example, higher chlorinated congeners tend to be more likely to bioconcentrate in the food chain, and they're found at higher levels in food, consequently. On the other hand, lower chlorinated congeners tend to be more volatile, and these often make up a greater proportion of the congeners found in air. So based on studies of oral PCB exposure in animals, mixtures with, let me see if I can get the pointer to work. Okay, The higher chlorine mixtures that have more higher chlorinated congeners and more dimer-like congeners are more potent at inducing hepatotoxic effects and effects on thyroid hormone homeostasis than mixtures that have higher amounts of lower chlorinated congeners. But data have suggested that there actually isn't much difference between these types of mixtures and those mixtures in causing immunotoxicity and neurotoxicity. So what this tells us is that studies of oral PCB exposure, the relationship between a mixture's congener content and its toxicity depends on what health effect you're looking at. And so we might expect the same type of complexity to exist for PCB inhalation, and that it won't be, higher rated mixtures are by default more toxic. It will depend on what the health endpoint is. So then how can we choose a PCB mixture to administer in an animal study if we want to use it in a human health risk assessment? One goal might be to use a localized mixture that has a congener profile that looks like what you might call a typical human inhalation exposure. But then you'd have to know what a typical inhalation exposure is for a human, and this is an area of uncertainty. So far, when people have looked at congener profiles in different geographical regions and in different contexts, there's been a lot of variability. For example, as shown here, congener profiles of outdoor air in Chicago were dominated by congeners with 5 chlorines or less, and that's the black line. But congener profiles of outdoor air in Rice Creek, New York, had a wide range of congeners, including those with as many as 8 or 9 chlorines. And that's the red line. In Germany, researchers noted that rooms contaminated with PCB-containing caulk contained more lower chlorinated congeners, and those are the white bars, compared to rooms with PCB-treated acoustic ceiling tiles, and they had more higher chlorinated congeners. So different congener patterns in indoor air may exist in buildings with different PCB sources and conditions, as one would probably expect. So to support human health risk assessment, more work is needed to measure specific PCB congeners in air so that we can better characterize and understand the range of mixtures that people might be exposed to. It's likely that toxicological data from a number of different mixtures is going to be needed to adequately assess human health risk across different exposure scenarios, indoors and outdoors and in different buildings. Preferably, both human studies and animal studies of PCB inhalation from this point forward will carefully characterize the congener profile of the PCBs in the exposure atmosphere, and that would make it easier to compare results across studies. Another additional factor for researchers to consider when planning studies of PCB inhalation exposure relates to the toxicological endpoints investigated. As described earlier, PCBs have been extensively tested in studies of oral exposure, but the mixtures used in those studies might be very different in congener composition compared to mixtures found in air. Previously, I said that the congeners in food are often more highly chlorinated, and so the mixtures that have been tested in oral exposure studies have often been more highly chlorinated. There may also be differences in tissue distribution or metabolism between inhalation and oral routes of exposure. And for these reasons, it's possible that inhalation studies will reveal toxicological endpoints that are susceptible to PCB exposure only by inhalation, that oral exposure may not cause these effects, but inhalation exposure does. And so based on the results of oral exposure studies, we do expect that neurodevelopment, immunity, and thyroid hormone homeostasis might be affected in PCB inhalation studies, but researchers should also be encouraged to investigate additional endpoints, even those that have not previously been shown to be associated with PCBs. So in conclusion, although we know that PCBs may be present at high levels in the air of some buildings, because there have been so few studies of PCB inhalation toxicity, we're limited in our ability to assess health risk to people who spend time in these buildings with confidence. So risk assessment efforts would benefit from additional inhalation exposure and toxicity information from new studies. And so we've suggested some studies, including human and animal-based investigations in which the degree of PCB exposure by inhalation is well characterized. In the animal studies, might consider using monkeys or rats as the model species, use a chronic or developmental exposure paradigm, and testing three or more PCB concentrations in air. And data from those studies would be very useful in reducing uncertainty in our risk assessments. Studies might focus on health endpoints known to be sensitive to PCB exposure, but investigation of other health endpoints is also important. And it would also be useful to have PBPK models describing the kinetic properties of airborne PCBs and individual PCB congener analyses across a wider range of human inhalation exposure scenarios, so we really know how much variability we're dealing with. And I'd like to conclude with that. Thank you so much for your time and attention. And I'm happy to answer any questions either now or at the end of the session, or if you have questions later, you can reach me using the contact information here and at the website. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. That was, again, very informative. Quite a few questions did come in. However, again, we're running a little bit behind time. And we agree there'll be time at the end of the call, and or if for some reason we don't get to any questions today, we'll certainly put you in touch with any of those audience participants who have questions that didn't get answered. But at this time, I would like to move on to our third and final speaker. We're pleased today that to have our calling in from Sweden. Dr. Niklas Johansson. In 1978, after PhD studies in Uppsala, Dr. Niklas Johansson came to the Swedish EPA. His first position at the agency was connected to planning and funding of research within the area of toxicology and health effects, but also acted as research coordinator within a number of different programs. At the research department, he also held the position as head of the unit for health effects. In 1988, he moved from the research department to the Department for Environmental Assessment. Today, he is mainly focused on POPs and international cooperation. To mention a few examples, within LRTAP POPs, he is one of the two Swedish representatives mainly focusing on new chemicals to be proposed for inclusion in the protocol. For the Stockholm Convention, he is, in cooperation with Chemicals Agency, dealing with similar items also involved in the national implementation plans. He also acts as Swedish representative in a number of Arctic programs. He left the Swedish EPA in April this year, but continues in these Arctic programs today as a consultant. In parallel to his activity in SEPA, he had ongoing research at the Karolinska Institute since the 1990s. When he began to explore the possibilities of using multivariate statistics to identify crucial associations between exposure and effects. He also took part in studies on the effects of dioxins and dioxin-like compounds on cell communication and the formation of pre-neoplastic foci in different systems. His work was often focused on experimental design, so based on the multivariate statistics and the evaluation of these results. During the last few years, he's been engaged in a project more focused on human exposure of different POPs and BPA. In cooperation with Annika Hanberg and others, he has performed a study on human exposure to PCBs in indoor air. Dr. Johansson, we welcome you to today's webinar.
Thank you so much, Heather. Let me first check that I come through in a crisp and clear way.
Yes, we can hear you very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, and I will also thank the organizers for inviting me to this webinar, and also to thanks to Gabi and Janice for so nicely setting the scene to, for this the last presentation in the webinar. I will not talk very much about research, but on what we should do with the knowledge we have. Of course, it's very right when both Gabby and Dennis say that we don't know all details of the risk related to airborne exposure of PCBs. But anyhow, we know enough to take a number of general actions in order to reduce human and environmental exposure to these compounds. And the global society, which I exemplify here with the Stockholm Convention on POPs, is one of three conventions, global conventions, that have the common objective of protecting human health and the environment from hazardous chemicals and waste. The other two, that's the Basel Convention and the Rotterdam Convention. This Stockholm Convention today has 179 parties, and there are five further signatories, that is, countries that have signed the protocol or the convention text, but they have not ratified it yet. And among these, that the U.S. belongs to this group of non-ratifying countries. That is, the country which is not yet a party to the convention. But we hope that that will happen eventually. This convention went into force in 2004, and use of POPs. The PCBs, they are listed in two of the annexes to this convention. That is the A on elimination, and Annex C that discuss the unintentional production of a number of compounds. That it includes the hexachlorobenzenes, it includes the dioxins, but also the PCBs. So, in the convention text on PCBs, it is said that specifically mentioned that this is for liquid PCB. It says that each party shall make determined efforts to identify, label, remove, etc., PCBs that of a certain concentration and in volumes above a certain volume, but also endeavor to identify and remove from use equipment that contains the PCB at a lower concentration and at lower volumes. And it also very nicely describes the waste problem. And here it's in cooperation with the Basel Convention, that the parties should make determined efforts to apply environmentally sound waste management of the PCB that has been identified and removed from certain equipment. And that this should be the global society, or at least the parties to the convention, should be done with this task no later than in 2028. There is also another interesting text on the PCB that is maybe more of interest to the specific problems of indoor air exposure to PCBs. That is to endeavor and to identify other articles containing more than 0.005% of PCB and manage them in accordance with a very lengthy article that describes the handling, the labeling, and the disposal of this. But it's more or less along the same line as it is more in detail described for the liquid PCBs. The convention then have made a number of different investigations just to see the progress of its works and its activities. And it could observe that in 2008, the global existence of PCBs was estimated to be up to 2.9 million tons. And many countries have spent a lot of work to reduce the occurrence of PCB in the society by inventories to eliminate and replace old equipment, and to also to find the best possible environmentally sound disposal of these PCBs. But still, there is a lot of work that lies ahead of us. And as a consequence of this observation, the convention decided to launch the PCB Elimination Network, and this was then endorsed by the Conference of Parties, which is the top level of the convention, and this was done in 2009. This PCB Elimination Network is focusing on the dissemination of information of how to meet the targets that have been set by the convention. And it's a lot about information and practical work. It's a print guidance material. We arrange a number of workshops worldwide. And here is an example of what one of these or two of these printed information sheets could look like. Some are very succinct, others are very longer. They could be up to 30 pages. Some others are just 2 pages, like this one. And they deals with these practicalities, that if you are going to look for PCBs in buildings or constructions, where should you look? We have heard about the cork. But where is the cork? It's on the facade, it's around windows, it's around doors, it's around balconies, etc., etc. And we need to inform the people that out in the field that should do these inventories, not to overlook any occurrence of this. But it also occurs indoors, the same caulking material or other caulking material in the ceilings, walls, floors, windows, around doors, etc., etc. And here are a number of examples of where it could be and how it could look. We have also heard, I think it was Gabby who mentioned that we can find the PCB in paint, but her example was occurrence that was not an unintentional occurrence of PCB in these paints. Here in the paints that are used in mostly in industrial building, but also in some with heavy use, where there is a lot of cleaning and you need a flooring material that is very resistant. There have been paints that contain up to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of PCB that could be directly on the floor or under a synthetic carpet. And here are a few examples from schools and other buildings. I think these pictures are taken in Switzerland. And also in the ceiling, we have these acoustic tiles. And here PCB was introduced as a flame retardant, which is another application that back in the early 70s was quite common. And we also have this small capacitors in fluorescent light equipment that also could contain up to 50 grams of pure PCB each. So it can add up to quite large amounts, just these fluorescent lights. Cables, mostly the cables in outdoor settings like these ones, but also some smaller cables that could be found indoors or inside buildings, at least. And lastly, another paint, but it's not really a paint, it's an anti-corrosion coating that has been often applied to pipelines. This is a drinking water pipeline in somewhere in Switzerland.
Excuse me, Dr. Johansson. I am very sorry to interrupt. This is Justin. We are not seeing your slides advanced, and I'm not sure if that's a problem of connectivity on our end or if you have not advanced the slides yet. But it seems
I have
back on the pen fact sheet slide. If you are advancing the slides, then just go ahead and proceed, and it we'll assume it's a connectivity issue on our end.
Should I go back to the fact sheet, or?
That's the slide we're stuck on. If you want to just advance the slides to where you're at, and I would remind the presenter or the participants that they can download these slides from the related URLs pod. Just click on the seminar resources, and you should be able to get to these slides. So just make sure, Dr. Johansson, that you are on the correct slide, and go ahead and proceed.
Yes. Sorry for that, but I have been advancing. Do you still see the fact sheet?
Yep, I do. So I believe the problem may be on our end. But go ahead and proceed, and I have instructed the participants to download the slides.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then my last information picture on what the use of PCBs in buildings could look like is a very bad picture, I would say. But it's on galbestos. I don't know if you have heard about galbestos, but actually that's the nasty mixture between asbestos and PCB that has been used in a number of industrial settings and high temperature settings. In the metallurgical industries, above all. So these fact sheets and other, something happened. Can you see the slides now?
Yep, I believe we are back on track. We are on the slide that says do.
Yes. We try to summarize in these fact sheets that could come down to almost one-liners that what you should do during the inventories and the downstream actions to the inventories. We say that you should avoid any direct contact with PCB suspect materials. You should verify these materials and have a representative samples analyzed as soon as possible. You should enable access to accredited laboratories which are qualified to analyze POPs, which is not so easy in a global perspective. In case of high PCB content in materials, you should verify possible indoor air contamination. You should visually check the condition of PCB in suspect materials regularly, so it won't deteriorate during the time, which is, of course, extremely important when it comes to these open applications. You should integrate open system applications on a national PCB inventories, and you should contact the regional environmental authority prior to any repair and or removal of this suspect materials. And there are, of course, a number of don'ts. Also, you should not remove suspect PCB materials yourself. You should reuse, recycle, or sandblast suspected material. Don't abandon or dump suspect PCB materials. Refrain from using simple test kits to determine PCB content. They are very often likely to provide false results. And the most important thing could be that never burn suspect PCB materials, as, of course, even more toxic compounds could be formed. Then I turn to a few experiences we have had nationally when it comes to PCBs in buildings here in Sweden. Just to give a very short background, in Sweden, PCB was banned in open applications in 1972. We had continuous or more or less continuous information to house owners on the situation that PCB could be in the buildings, and they should observe that when they were renovating buildings during 1980s and the good part of the 1990s. In the mid-1990s, the EcoCycle Council, which is an organization for the house owners, both private and the public house owners, the housing owners, to perform an inventory of the situation, but also to make a remediation of if they found PCB in the houses. They made a good job, but they couldn't complete it. So we had to make a new ordinance on PCBs in 2007. That relates to the occurrence of the PCB in buildings and constructions. And in this ordinance, it's described that the house owners should investigate and remediate the buildings that were renovated or built during 1956 to 1973. And the inventory should be done with by 2008, and the remediation should be done with between 2014 to 16. There are different deadlines for different categories of buildings in this. It's also prescribed that the PCB-containing waste that will occur must be handled by authorized personnel only. and it should be destroyed by a thermal destruction, and it's not allowed to be deposited on landfills. Other methods could be applied if they are equivalent to the incineration with respect to long-term environmental impact. And as far as I know, we don't have any such methods at hand. The Swedish approach has been, as we have been working with this for quite some time, it all started up to reduce the human and environmental exposure to PCB. And the focus has been on the removal of all important open PCB depots, not only those directly to PCBs in indoor air. And the main purpose has, as I said, been to reduce human environmental exposure. We of course, it's the inhalation exposure is always occurring in addition or on top of the exposure via food. So it's the effect that we see is actually the combination of the exposure via different droughts. But of course, we have observed this extra argument to perform the remediation of buildings, that we can reduce also the direct exposure via indoor air. In 2010, some 70% of the buildings that might hold PCBs had been investigated. The big real estate companies, they were quite quick with this, but the smaller ones have been, I wouldn't say lazy, but they haven't had the real power to perform this. And there is actually some lack of equipment and personnel that could make the inventories, but also to make the cleanup in the houses. There have been also a side effect that we have had a high activity on the development of specific tools and other equipment when it comes to the remediation. And here is one example with a special rotating knife, which is attached to a high-effect vacuum cleaner. And you see also these guys that work on the facade. They have fresh air inlet here, so they are not directly exposed, because in this area it could be elevated exposure. That's just one example of the development. There are many others. We have done a few studies that come to the the same result that have been found in the U.S., that have been found in Germany, in Denmark, and many other countries, that we can see profound differences in the indoor concentrations in these contaminated houses. But the outdoor concentration outside the houses, we don't see much difference there. Uh-huh. Oh, there it is. This is from a study we made a couple of years ago on, this is PCB in blood in people living in buildings with and without PCBs in the sealants. And you can see that all these congeners, maybe 15 of them that is on this graph, are above this red line, which is 1. And if it's above one, then you have an increased concentration. And you see that the congeners 28, 74, and 66. We didn't see much of 52 in this building. There were other buildings that had a lot of 52, but not in this building. That's the major part of that changed it. But all the others, and also the total, is above one of the ratio in this ratio calculation. And this is, of course, very, very different than the pattern that you get from the food exposure. So the contamination activities, more or less in 2010, a few municipalities, they were done with this. And the contamination part, and some 50% of the total, the contamination was done by then. Today, I would estimate, we don't have this data, but I would estimate it's more like 75%. There are quite a number of people working with this, that people that have undergone certain courses how to perform the decontamination. Some 400 people are working with this today. So the conclusions then could be that most of the inventors have been carried out. The contamination will hopefully be completed during 2014 or 16. Approximately 100 tons, this was again in 2010, of pure PCB, out of some 240 tons in the beginning, remain to be decontaminated. I would say it's less than 100 tons today. And a very important conclusion here is that we can say that we can see it's possible to both to identify and to remove PCBs still present in buildings and construction. It can be done. We have shown that in practice. And we must consider that we today probably have our last opportunity to prevent this PCB from escaping out into the environment, and it will not stay there. It will eventually turn back to us in our food commodities. I think that was the last. I thought there was one more, but okay. So I thank you for listening to this, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Johansson. There were a couple questions that were specifically directed towards your talk, and why don't we start with those that came in online, and then we'll move to the more general questions that came up. So one question that came in from Jorin Campoyano is whether the U.S. Signed the Stockholm Convention, and how does that translate to the policy in the U.S.? And goes on to ask, do specific agencies play a role in implementation of these international agreements? In other words, would the EPA have a role? Maybe Janice would also like to chime in on that.
Exactly. I cannot give the full story on this. I can see that during the meetings in both the Conference of Parties, but also in other working groups that are aiding the Conference of Parties or the Secretariat with the material, U.S. is always there. They are active, and they do a lot of good work, but they don't have a voice when it comes to votings or when it comes to certain kinds of proposals that they can set. and it, which is of course the U.S. is the only, I would say, country among the real big countries that are lacking in the family. And we have China, we have India, we have Russia, etc. We lack U.S., we lack North Korea, and a few others.
Great, and let me mention that another person has chimed in to clarify that the U.S. has signed the Stockholm Convention but has not ratified it, which goes along with what you were saying. Another questions that have come up from a couple of different people. Sylvia Tari asks, what is the most environmentally sound method of disposing PCBs? And then a follow-up from Christina Giorgio is, how is the caulk being remediated? Encapsulation, patch and repair, remove and replace, and how is the remediation being paid for? So two sort of related questions.
Yeah. If I start with the waste problem and the environmental sound disposal, we have not used anything else but high temperature incineration. That's the only method we know about that can decompose PCBs in an in such a way that it will not cause further damage. But of course we need an incineration equipment that could do this. And you need filters, you need a lot of things around it. Actually in Sweden we just have one such facility. So it has a lot to do with not only with PCBs, there are a number of other things that needs to be incinerated. There have been trials to use destruction in cement kilns, but they should produce good cement, and that's their purpose, and they could not always optimize also as a good destruction facilities for PCBs and other pots.
Question was who pays for it?
As we started up with this voluntary initiative from the house owners organization, and a lot of them made a good job, and they managed to go to the very end, to get this material out, to label it and package it in specialized container and transport it to the incineration facility without any cost for the state, for the ministry or anyone else. Of course, it comes on the people that live in these buildings, they have to pay for it. But it couldn't be a surprise for a house owner that this material actually has been in the houses for 50 years almost, that it need to be renovated in some way. I think that it must be in their calculations. It's quite surprising that it has been so durable as it has been. I think it is, economically it's been a good affair for the house owners and therefore also for the people living there, but when it comes to pure economy. So there are no governmental money put into this, only for information.
Okay, and that includes the incineration itself.
Yes, the cost for the incineration also is by the house owners.
Okay. And then a couple of other questions have come in. What was the limit that Sweden used for removal in buildings reminding us that EPA's TSCA building limit is 55 parts per million as comparison. So what was the Swedish value used?
I think we ended up down in the 500, or if it was 50. I can't tell you off the top of my head, but we rather searched an area where there could be no discussions. We know that there are a number of buildings that have very, very low concentration, and that's not really contaminated. It is a result of contamination when these sealants or caulking materials were put in. To be effective, to have any purpose, the PCB must be in the sealant and caulking material in concentrations of percent. It could be between 3 up to 20% could be a PCB. Actually, the highest I've seen in an analysis has been 35% of pure PCB in the sealant. So we would like to go for these the very high one first, but and avoid a discussion, avoid to put a limit when we could have a discussion whether this was above or below certain limits, of find an area where we couldn't find any the buildings that really was in that area. That was the practical solution to it.
Okay, thanks. A number of questions have come in. I will give phone participants an opportunity to ask a question if they have any questions. At this time, we can start going over questions for any of the presenters today, and again, a lot have come in online. There's not going to be enough time to get to them today, I can see, but we will definitely get back to you if your question was not answered. We will send you an email later on. But I will open up the phone lines to see if there are any phone participant questions. Again, what you would need to do is press *7 to take your phone off of mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question, and then you can remute your phone by pressing *6. And again, this is for any of the presenters. *7 to unmute, *6 to remute.
This is Dan Kraft, a former EPA employee who is now retired.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Johansson. In the studies done in Sweden where air samples were collected, was there any introduction of outside air into the area being tested for PCB concentration? Did they attempt to isolate the area?
I'm not certain if I understood your question. You mean if we had an increased ventilation? Is that your question?
Yes. I mean, if one were to look to try to find out what the PCB concentration was in a room, while the air sample is being collected, I would not introduce any outside air, but some of the work that has been done over the last couple of years, they actually open windows while they're collecting the samples.
Okay. Then I understand the question better. Investigation that I was part of, that was performed in the autumn. I think it was quite late autumn, so it was quite cool outside, and people don't open the windows very often in Sweden in under these conditions. So I would say they kept the generally they kept the windows closed, I would guess. But we also told them, because this was quite, we took these samples by passive samplers, not to cause any noise in their living rooms or bedrooms or wherever we took the samples. That resulted in we had the time that was needed to take the samples was around 2 weeks. And we said that they should live completely normal and do what they usually do. If they open the balcony 15 minutes per day, they should continue with that. No restriction, just continue with their normal life. So nothing special due to this. We try to reflect the concentrations and the secondary, also the exposure that these people that lived in the flats actually were exposed to.
Thank you. The air monitoring that I'm familiar with took a period of about 6 to 7 hours, and during some of the sampling, room air exchanges up to 5 to 10 or more air exchanges were available because of vents that were removing air from the space being tested with the windows open, or in some cases air conditioners on, which would be vented to the outside and with the fans bringing outside air in.
Yeah, I guess that's more problematic if you have such a design on your study. You get difficulties to get a reliable estimate of the current exposure of people living in these flats. And if you just have 6 or 7 hours, then it's an active sampling procedure.
Yes.
So I'd like to see if we can move on and see if maybe there is another question from our phone participants. Thank you for that question, Dan Kraft. Pressing *7 takes your phone off mute. Are there any other questions from our phone participants? Okay, this time I'd like to take another question that came in online. This is from Mark Madaloni. He asks, are there any occupational studies of workers that monitored airborne exposure that could be used to characterize dose response through the inhalation route? And that might be best directed towards Janice, or?
Yeah, that sounds like that's probably for me.
Okay.
And thank you for the question, Mark. And to my knowledge, as of probably the last time I checked the literature, which may be a couple months now, so no, the answer is no, that there haven't been, there are occupational studies that have looked at inhalation exposures, but none of the exposure assessments in those studies have been rigorous enough for us to be able to use them for dose response assessments. Plus, in many occupational studies, with the exception of one fairly recent study that was of workers who were involved in remediation of buildings with PCB-contaminated caulk, but earlier occupational studies, like workers who worked with aerochlors in like the electronic industry, they also generally had inhalation exposure, but also dermal exposure, and sometimes the dermal exposure was to an even greater extent than the inhalation exposure, so it kind of runs into the same problem as and many of those exposure assessments are based on blood levels, and so it runs into the same sort of problems as other epidemiological studies. And the caulk remediation study, I think that it provided PCB levels in caulk, but may not have provided PCB levels in air. I know that we were not able to use it for dose response, but I can't remember the specific reason for that study. But I guess the short answer to the question is no, there are none available, unless something has been published in the past couple of months. And then I'd love to hear about it.
I could add to this, Niklas, you want some here, that there have been a few follow-up, not big studies, but a few small follow-up studies on the people that you saw the guy with the special equipment working outside the building to take out the sealants and how he was protected. And from that we know that this protection that he has, it leads to that, oh, that's the guy, yeah. It results in a protection that you can't see any extra exposure to these people that perform this work if they have this protective equipment.
Yes, that might be the explanation.
Well, this is Gabrielle. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. Being a teacher in a school that is contaminated is sort of occupational exposure, although sort of, when you see teachers as an occupation. And they looked at the air levels in the air and in the blood of the teachers and found elevated levels of lower chlorinated PCBs, same levels as the control people outside of the school with respect to the higher chlorinated ones. But how much that is usable for dose response, Janice and Niklas know better.
Right.
These studies were done in Germany, and Bob Herrick as well has some of those data.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Those studies do give us a lot of information about the relationship between inhalation exposure and what PCB body burden, how it
yeah.
might look different. But there were no toxicological effects measured
no.
in those
mm-hmm.
teachers. So, and that's what would be necessary for the dose response assessment, because we can get an idea of dose from that, but not a response.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, there was one where they looked at genotoxicity in the lymphocytes and they didn't see anything, which is not so surprising.
That's good, but...
yes.
So, thanks for fielding that question and for providing additional information about occupational exposures. Kind of on a related note, we got another question, just in general, coming to the point of these webinars, is how do you feel about PCBs in schools? Do you think that we should leave the PCBs in place? That's certainly been a suggestion to manage these PCBs by leaving them in place, but that would potentially continue to expose school-age children. So would leaving PCBs in place put children in potential harm's way?
Okay, this is Janice. I personally, I feel like we don't know enough, or we know less than we'd like to about dose response in terms of PCB inhalation, but we know enough about PCBs to know that inhaling them is probably not good. So I think that leaving them in place is probably not the course that we want to follow. However, to what extent they need to be remediated is going to be the area of contention, and that can only be answered by if we know, if we can identify a level that we think would be safe. And right now we have identified a level that we can say with with uncertainty that we expect to be safe based on oral exposure studies, but we would be able to have a lot more confidence in that if we had data from inhalation studies.
Yeah, if I could add to this, I would certainly not recommend to leave PCBs in these buildings, because our experiences tells us very clearly that it's not only that these contaminate the indoor air, but also the PCBs are escaping out into the environment, and then it will go around there for a considerable time, and parts of it will come back to us and prolong the exposure that we all have from via food. So, I must be back to this, that the important thing when it comes to the human health risk assessment, it must be based on the total exposure. Not to make a brilliant study on the indoor air or the inhalation studies and the specific effect, because this we are all exposed both to the contaminated food, and some of us have all on top of that the indoor air exposure. And when it comes down to the body burden of PCBs, I don't think it really matters very much when it comes to the effects, except for that we have different patterns of the composition of PCBs that we could be exposed to.
Yeah, and maybe I may say something there. Indoor, it's especially the 52, 28, 101, 110. Those are more those neurotoxic ones. And honestly, when I see that there's the 95 is in the air, you know, and that's very neurotoxic and correlated to autism, correlated to Parkinson's, I'm getting a little... I wonder why we have this increase in autism in our society, why we have this increase in Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases that worries me. I think we have to learn much, much more. We need to learn much, much more before we really can make an informed decision here. And in the meantime, we should just err on the side of caution. And where it's possible, like removing the light ballasts is, I think, not such a big deal. So why not do it in the schools when they are the old ones with PCBs? So remove sources where it is possible and try to be as vigilant as possible. That's my attitude. Especially also when you consider we are not only exposed to PCBs, but then we have the PBDEs in our homes. We have, as Niklas says, the air, the food exposure. And that means we have mixtures. And with respect to AH receptor, it's all additive. With respect to ryanodine receptor, it's additive. So when we can remove an exposure somewhere or lower it, we should do it.
Great, and you did touch on the autism studies, and just offline, we did get an email asking for the references for the PCB links to autism, so we just wanted to let people know that we will post that information. If Gabi, you could provide that for us.
Yeah, it's a paper from last year, and again, it's the UC Davis group. I can pull that out.
Okay, great. We'll post that on the additional resources. There was a question that came in fairly early, and again, just coming back to the question at hand for the webinar, do we have an assessment for how many schools would be contaminated at the level of concern for TSCA, which is 50 parts per million? I don't know if that's something Janice might have an idea about.
There has been a handful of schools that have been investigated in different, like in New York City, for example, but we do not have, and Mark Mataloni, if he's still on the line, might be able to answer this in more detail, but we do not have like a nationwide, we can only guess that schools that were built in the right time period may contain building materials that contain PCBs, especially caulk or light ballasts that might contain PCBs at those levels. But we don't know the number.
Okay.
Yeah, I think quite a lot, but it may, as the results that we have so far show, it differs from schoolroom to schoolroom. Mm-hmm. And also then with no guidance, I know very few countries have limits for indoor air exposure levels. So I know Germany has 300 nanograms per cubic meter is the tolerable level. And a lot of the schoolrooms that were tested in the New York area were above 500 and higher. So there I would say we should consider what can be done to lower the level. And very often it's increasing ventilation is one method. When windows are removed and replaced with high-efficiency windows, it should be done the right way, the way Niklas explained it, not just ripping them out, but doing it the right way. And so a lot can be done if we have the sensitivity for it and the attention to it.
Right. One issue that makes it difficult to get numbers like that in the United States is that there is no testing requirement under TSCA. So unless the caulk in a school building, for example, unless it's tested, we don't know how much PCB there is in it, and there's no requirement that it be tested. So schools don't have to check to see if there are PCBs. So there's no way to really gather that information with any certainty. We can only speculate that the number of potential school buildings where it could be a problem is fairly high.
And, just kind of as a question that Aaron Klein asked, what are our professional liabilities for buildings other than schools? Do we not extend the same level of care in terms of identifying and remediating, or is the standard of care different for schools? And sounds like even at this point we don't know fully the scope of what's happening in schools.
Right, and schools, the reason, at least in New York City, the reason that it became an issue is that a parent took a caulk sample during a caulk remediation at one of the public schools and had it tested. And then once it's known that there's that level of PCBs there, then there are, remediation efforts were initiated and different organizations got involved. But in the absence of a triggering event like that, we just don't know, and there's no way to force the issue. And so even for schools, the standard isn't very high. It's the same as for every, lots of public buildings this is probably an issue for, not just schools. They're just, a lot of attention has been drawn to them because children go there, and this became an issue for New York City.
Yeah.
Mm. The Swedish approach has then been not to concentrate on schools or any other certain category of buildings, but just any building where people can be exposed, or buildings, even the buildings where people don't live, but the PCB is actually leaving or being emitted to the outside air. That's fully enough to take actions according to the ordinance that was issued in 2007. So we find it in schools, not particularly often in schools. You see it more in industrial building and ordinary housing. And as far as I can remember, the very highest levels of indoor air we have seen in Sweden has been in a hospital. So it's really surprising, because there they had used the same kind of caulking material on the inside as on the outside. And it too was a very expensive and lengthy procedure to get this material out without closing the hospital. We had to do it room by room by room.
Well, folks, this is certainly the presentations that were given today, as well as last week, certainly points to the need for further research, further monitoring. I would even say environmental solutions to this issue. We did hear from Mark Mataloni, who clarified that 750 of the 1,500 New York City public schools are believed to have PCB-containing ballast or caulk. So that gives us an idea, at least within, that's just New York City. So really, truly the scope of this, not only in schools, but as was mentioned, in office buildings and in hospitals, it's a far-reaching issue. So,
yeah. Heather?
Yes.
May I not point out that the discussion will go on. We hope we will get many more data, but there will be a specific PCB workshop at Woods Hole in October. And for those who are interested and want to discuss this issue with the experts, they should consider to come to Woods Hole early October, because all the experts will be there.
Thank you, Dr. Ludwig. In fact, that's a adequate segue, because we did want to make sure that people knew about that workshop, which is going to be happening October 5th through 9th, again, at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And that is information that is posted on the seminar resources page that's associated with the original website linking to this webinar. We will continue to post announcements there. We will also have our presenters respond directly to the questions that we were unable to answer during today's webinar. Certainly the webinar generated a lot of interest, and so I certainly want to thank our three presenters for taking the time to let us know more about the health and exposure issues, as well as how we're able to piece the information that we know to make, as best as we can, an assessment of risk as well. So certainly this is just the start of our understanding of the full scope of PCBs and their use in building materials and the impact in health, not only for schools, but also for other buildings and other workers, therefore. So we thank you, Dr. Ludwig, Dr. Lehman, and Dr. Johansson, for your time today. And with that, I would like to conclude the webinar. Again, additional questions that have come in, whether it's regard to any specific speaker or just other background questions about needing additional information, we will be sure to provide that to you offline. So at this time, I'd like to thank you for your participation and say goodbye.